The issue that I did want to discuss was the issue of that you are raising is the issue of Galus Mitzrayim. The issue that's raised in these parashas of the Jewish people entering Mitzrayim, entering Egypt, and on their way down to Mitzrayim, Yaakov Avinu is going down to Mitzrayim, and all the Shvatim are going down to Mitzrayim. And they're obviously, they think maybe that they're going just to get some food, and maybe they'll come back. But ultimately, as we know, the history speaks for itself, that they ended up going to Mitzrayim and staying for 210 years, and that's what we know as Galus Mitzrayim, the exile that the Jewish people had in Mitzrayim, and the exodus from there is everything that we celebrate in Pesach and all that. So in other words, this whole process of getting the Jewish people down to Mitzrayim was not just to get food ultimately, but in the larger sense, it was the Jewish people's first trip into exile. And as we keep on the theme that we mention over and over again in Sefer Bereishis, which is, you know, I was just listening to a tape, Sefer Bereishis, we experience the Avos. We experience the forefathers of our nation, the characters in the Shvatim and the Avos. And I was listening to a tape, and he said his father, the Rav who was speaking, said his father would always say at the end of Parshas Vayichi, he said, this year we have to say goodbye to the Avos, and Emir Hashem, we'll see you again next year. Because it's like a very, you know, if you really learn the parashas and you can feel connected to the characters and the people that we learn about, it's a very powerful, there are a lot of powerful messages. And what's very powerful is that we've mentioned is Maisa Avos Simin Labonim. That the things which the Avos, what happened in to the forefathers, is a microcosm of really the rest of Jewish history. So if we want to know, one of the main challenges of Jewish history that we've experienced is exile. The Jewish people in exile. What do we do? How do we survive? And the fact that we have survived and the miracles that have taken place to enable us to survive, that's really the biggest miracle in Jewish history. Or maybe in the history of the world at all, some say, you know? Mm-hmm. So the way for us to learn is, again, looking at the Avos and seeing how do they deal with Galus. Okay, now there's a very interesting Mesha Chochma. Mesha Chochma is Ramea Simcha Midvinsk, who was a contemporary of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and in that generation, he was Ramea Simcha was the Gadol Hadar. So, he has a very interesting Ha'ara, very interesting point in the parasha, and that is the following. If you look in the Psukim in last week's parasha, when Yaakov is going down to Mitzrayim, he stops in Be'er Sheva on the way, and he receives a prophecy. Okay, but there's one word over here I want to focus on, which is like this. It says, "Vayomer Elokim li Yisrael, b'maros halayla." What's maros halayla? Maros halayla. Halayla is a dream at night. He saw it at halayla, nighttime. He saw it at night. Vayomer Yaakov, vayomer hineni. So he appears to him at night. Rameir Simcha says, if you look at the other prophecies that happened to Yitzchak and their prophecies that Yitzchak and Avram experienced, they never experienced prophecy at night. You'll never find by the other Avos that they had the Nevuah at night. Their Nevuah was always during the day. Yaakov, on his way down to Mitzrayim, here experiences a Nevuah at night. That's one point. That's what he says. But I was thinking that there's another place that Yaakov experienced Nevuah at night. Any ideas?
Sure.
Well, when he initially ran away, down to Lavan, he sleeps and he has that famous prophecy, that famous vision of the ladder, right?
How do we know that it was at night?
Because it says, Vayivka b'makom, right, the sun set early, and he went to sleep.
Right.
So it doesn't say in the Pasuk at night, but it was at night. So two places, Yaakov experiences Nevuah at night, and none of the others ever experienced Nevuah at night. Yeah. So Mesha Chochma says, because he doesn't say about the case down to Lavan, but I think it's the exact same point. Both of these cases, Yaakov was going down to Galus. The first case was he was leaving Be'er Sheva to go to Lavan's house. Right? Then then after that whole experience with Lavan, got his whole family and everything that happened there, he goes back to Eretz Yisrael. Then he leaves Eretz Yisrael again. And again, on the way out of Eretz Yisrael, the second time also, he gets Nevuah at night. So says the Mesha Chochma, what's the idea? What's the idea of getting a prophecy at night? So he says, the idea is, Hashem is telling you, even at night, even when it's dark, in Galus, in exile, and you don't see the hand of Hashem so clearly, still, at night, you're still going to receive the prophecy. You're still going to be able to see that I'm with you. So don't worry about the fact that you're going into Galus. I'm going to be with you at night also. I'm going to be with you during the dark times. I'll be with you even when you don't see it so clearly. And that's the idea that Yaakov receives this nevuah. The other avos never experienced galus in this sense, if you think about it. Avram experienced a short time in Plishtim, and he went down to Mitzrayim to get some food. He came back. Yitzchak never left Eretz Yisrael altogether. So the other avos, again, we learn lessons from each av. Avram, we learn Maisa Avos from Avram, from Yitzchak. But the Maisa Avos that we experience, that we're learning from Yaakov, if we want to know how to deal with Golus, that's the Maisa Avos of Yaakov. He's the Av of Golus. And that's, you know, for us, is basically for the existence of the Jewish people is the biggest challenge. So we have to try to glean a little bit from Yaakov Avinu's experiences in these parashiyas to try to understand what is it that we can learn from him. And what's the secret that the Torah is telling us about how a Jew is supposed to act and in order to survive the exile? So,
with due respect, I mean, I'm just a guy, but I'm just like you. My servos, some of the bunim. There's no record of Yaakov attempting to go back to Eretz Israel. In other words, there was no pull. Are we to understand that we should settle outside? I mean, if we are already, for whatever one reason or another, taken outside the going to Galus, should we settle in Galus?
Oh, so, well, first of all, you see that. What? Yeah, but one thing is that he does want to go back to Eretz Yisrael. He wants to be buried there. And as he asks to be buried there, it could be that it wasn't realistic for him to really go back. I mean, he was planted in Goshen. He had everything he needed. Yosef set him up. And now he's an old man. I mean, it's hard for him maybe to go back at that point, number one. But I actually did see a point here. I just saw something tonight about this. You know what? I saw tonight a vart about this exact point from Reb Chatzkel Abramsky. Reb Chatzkel Abramsky was also in the war years, and then he went to England and he became the Rav in England, and then eventually moved to Eretz Yisrael. He wrote a lot of Sfarim. Reb Chatzkel Abramsky was a Talmud of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. He was the next generation after Rav Meir Simcha. So Reb Chatzkel Abramsky makes the exact same point that you're making. And he says, you see that you have to kind of take Hashem's signs for when it's time. You don't fight your way back out of Galus necessarily. You have to, Hashem leads you. And as a matter of fact, you have to wait for when it's time that Hashem tells you it's going to be time to leave Galus. And he says the Pasuk, and I don't want to sound like Satmar, I'm not sounding like Satmar over here, but he does say, he says like this, he says, and probably the activity of Yaakov is because of the following Pasuk. It says, Anoichi ered imcha mitzrayma, I will go down with you to Mitzrayim. But then it says, Va'anoichi a'alcha gam alo, I'm going to raise you out of Mitzrayim. So says Reb Chatzkel Abramsky, that's why you don't find that Yaakov or his children tried to leave. Because it says, Anoichi alcha, I'm going to take you out. So wait till it's time. That's what happened in the end, right? They didn't try to leave. They waited, and all of a sudden Hashem comes out of left field, and he comes with the miracles, and he comes with the Yitzias Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, and eventually they left. But the point is that they didn't. Now, he does say, at the end of that piece, he says, and even though I'm telling you that we shouldn't fight our way back, but we should definitely all make the effort to go back peacefully. That he does say in that piece that I saw tonight. He says we could make an effort to go back to Israel peacefully, just not forcefully. But the pasuk that he's medayik is, it says, I mamash saw this probably an hour ago, this vart. Yeah. Before I left, I opened up a sefer. Yeah, no, but it's mamash this vart. It says it in the pasuk.
It was at night.
Yeah, it was at night. But you hear the diak in the pasuk? It says, Anoichi a'ered imcha mitzrayma, I will take you down to Mitzrayim, va'anoichi, and I, a'alcha gam aloy, and I will be the one that will take you out. That's what it says, I will be the one to take you out. So that's why he says that you never find the Jewish people themselves made the effort to come out. They waited all the years in Mitzrayim until HaKadosh Baruch Hu was actually going to physically take them out. So he says that's also myself a similar banim in that regard. But again, so that's an issue of that became controversial you know, at the beginning of the establishment of the State of Israel. But
so you made a point earlier, I think you were quoting Rambam, that he was asking how come for 20 years Yosef was silent. Is it possible to simply say that Yosef, being a clever man, a wise man, understood that his presence is what caused all this hatred among his brothers, and that his presence created a dynamic in the story that the Yaakov couldn't really, he was obsessed with him, and he wasn't being fair to the to all his sons. So he didn't want to go back into that maelstrom, that dynamic, and he wanted to keep out of it. That's why he didn't want to get back in. And that's why suddenly he was asking all these questions from the brothers, and he sees that there are changes, the dynamics have changed. But for him to, it would have started the whole
The question really that's raised at that point is why didn't he feel bad for his father and just tell his father that he's still alive and forget, you know, that's really the focus of the question.
Right, because if he knew his father was not balanced in his view about him, it would have started the whole mess again.
Okay, it's possible. It's possible.
I'm just suggesting,
you know, there is a point that some of the Mefarshim say that he wanted to wait and see how would they react. Would they stand up and protect Binyamin? Or because Binyamin is also a son of Rachel. So, yeah, that did the dynamic change. There is, that point is made. But
that would answer the Ramban. You know,
yeah. That point is made. But getting back to this point, yeah, no, that's a good point.
I interrupted.
The point that we're discussing is to learn what we can from the Jewish people's original entry into Egypt, which was here. You know, Yaakov and the sons going down to Mitzrayim, to learn what we can from that in order to, for ourselves, to protect ourselves in exile, to protect ourselves in Galus. What can we learn from Yaakov Avinu? So first, let's go back to the Meshech Chochma. So the Meshech Chochma makes an interesting point. And he says the following. He says, the halacha is, we say, that a person can receive nevuah in Chutz La'aretz. This is a question that the Poskim, that there's Gemara about it. Can a person receive prophecy outside Eretz Yisrael? Is it possible? Or does Hashem only reveal himself to people in Eretz Yisrael? So there's a Gemara. There's a Gemara in Moed Katan. The Gemara in Moed Katan says that one can receive prophecy outside of Eretz Yisrael. But, says the Gemara, that's only for a person who once received prophecy in Eretz Yisrael. So if you received prophecy in Eretz Yisrael, then when you leave Eretz Yisrael, you bring it with you. You can receive prophecy again in Chutz La'aretz, but you can't receive prophecy in Chutz La'aretz if you've never received it in Eretz Yisrael. That's what the Gemara says.
Moshe?
Huh?
Moshe Rabbeinu?
What was the first initial time? The Sneh. When he, the burning bush incident?
Uh-huh, so you're going to say that that
so
was...
So that was his first meeting with Hashem.
I see.
So where was that? That was, I'm not sure. Somewhere between Mitzrayim and, you know. But maybe that's on Moshe's level anyway. Mm-hmm. So Moshe, but I hear your point. But that's what he brings from the Gemara, the Meshech Chochma. So he wants to say that that applies on a communal level as well. And he says this is the number one lesson that we have to take for Galus. And he says on the communal level, what it means is that the Jewish people on a whole, as much as they represent the values that they represented when they were not in exile, pre-exile, you know, the values that the Jewish people maintained when they were under the Hashgacha Pratis of Hashem, when they were under in the Beis HaMikdash and they had Hashem's presence. So it was so clear to them, Hashem, when you were walking to the Beis HaMikdash and you see what's going on over there, you know, it was basically, you know, you saw Hashem in front of your eyes. This is his house, you know, it's like he's living here. People are bringing karbonos. This is like, it was impossible to deny any sort of seeing a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And then all of a sudden you go to exile. If you can maintain those values and maintain that level, then he says, you get, then it's like you're connected with the Jewish people the way they were in Eretz Yisrael. Then you can receive the same level of Hashgacha Pratis that you received in Eretz Yisrael, you could receive it again in Chutz La'aretz. So he says, just like on an individual level, a person who received prophecy in Eretz Yisrael can receive prophecy again in outside of Eretz Yisrael, it's also on a communal level. As long as we maintain our values that we had in Eretz Yisrael and we bring those with us in Galus, then we'll also have the Hashgacha Pratis. And we'll have a Kadosh Baruch Hu watching over us the same way he did in Eretz Yisrael in Chutz La'aretz. So that number one point is not to cut ourselves off from those values and that the whole, you know, keep the Mesorah, keep the tradition going. That's the number one key. And he says that's kind of the whole idea that the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, they didn't change their name, they didn't change their clothing. Why are those things so significant? And the reason is because that's the connection. You have to have the connection to the past. Keeping the connection to the past is what keeps us going right now, is because we feel we're still connected. And that's, like we mentioned one time before here, is how you could really see Torah was replanted constantly, so we're always connected. You know, you'll hear, you want to say, well, you know, I don't have anything to do with the yeshivas of Europe, with Mir Yeshiva and Slabodka Yeshiva, like those are good places, but every person was affected by a Talmud of somebody that survived those yeshivas and brought the Mesorah over from Europe. That eventually that Mesorah is back, all the way back to, you know, that's how we're here. We're here because of the Mesorah, you know. So that's why traditional things are very important, you know. And what this is very important, because what happens a lot of times is that people, you know, it becomes very, let's say right today, I don't want to get controversial, I don't know, you know, but there's a lot of things that come up. For example, I'm being taped here, but in when it comes to the order of prayer. You know, do we allow women to read the Megillah and these type of things, or different things? And the way that some people address the issue is saying, well, look, is there anything that's halachically wrong with it? You have to find, is it permissible according to the halacha? And if you can't find any place in Shulchan Aruch that you could point your finger to and say, well, here it says you can't do it. If you can't find it, then it's mutter, then we can allow it. Because why not? It doesn't say anywhere. But there's missing a point that if it was never done before, it's a lack of the Mesorah, it's a lack of the tradition. And what's the only thing that's keeping us going more than Shulchan Aruch is the fact that we're still connected, is the tradition. So it's very important that's a very important factor. People try to minimize it and say, well, they didn't do it and social times are different. But it's true, maybe, but the Mesorah ultimately is a very, very key factor, because that's really what keeps us going. You know, we have in the Kollel, there's a man that comes, learns in the Kollel every afternoon, and he learned, and he actually studied in yeshiva when he was his bar mitzvah age, a young boy in yeshiva in Budapest, in Hungary, before, you know, and he grew up in Europe, and he came, so he grew up so rich from the house and from the way everything was done. His Yiddishkeit is so real and so rich. So everything we're learning is like, yeah, okay, like, don't bog me down with the Shulchan Aruch. My mother did that. Like, it's obvious. Like, you know, that's the way we did it in our house. Mishnah Berurah, this, it's true. Of course we did that, but it didn't matter where it said it. That's the way we did things in the house. And it makes such a rich Yiddishkeit. So really the Mesorah, in a way, is a way to keep us even stronger. You know, is what has kept the Jewish people throughout the years. So even if you won't be able to point to a place in Shulchan Aruch and say, well, that's where it says it's also, it doesn't make a difference necessarily. I mean, obviously you need Rabbanim to tell you what's Mesorah, what's not, but, you know, in general, the concept...
Is that where you get Minhag? Minhag is, it becomes Halacha?
Yeah, yeah. Minhag is stronger than Halacha sometimes. I'm giving a shiur in the Kollel on the laws of lending and borrowing with interest, Hilchos Ribbis. So I said there, so as in the first year, that someone told me one time, someone said, you want to bring a proof that minhag is stronger than halacha. because the halacha says that when you borrow money, you have to pay back, but the minhag is not to. So you see that. But anyway, you know, there's that story that the Kotzker was a very sharp man. The Kotzker Rav, Reb Mendel Mikotsk. He always had very sharp lines. Anyway, so Chassa came to me and he said, I don't know what to do because I bring milk into the shtibel every day and people steal the milk. People are always stealing the milk. You know, I bring it in and by the time I want to go get my coffee, it's not there anymore. So what he said, right on the milk, it's not Chalav Yisrael. So he came back and it wasn't stolen. It was there. And so the Kotzker said, it's a shame that Lo Sigzol, the prohibition of stealing, is a shame that Lo Sigzol is not a minig.
That's funny.
It's hilarious. It would be, you know. So, but it's true. And that's a very important thing. And the people, often you find that the minig, and it's a very powerful thing. You know, and that's a very strong way that in Galus, a person in Galus identifies with that in a way much more than other things. And it's a very important thing to keep that Masera. That's what gets, you know, so that's number one thing. So this is an idea of being connected to the past. But there's a beautiful idea from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and he twists it a little bit the other way, and it's the opposite. And he says like this. He says, another very important way for us to survive in Galus is the following. He says, there's a medrash, a beautiful medrash. The medrash says that Yaakov Avinu brought to Mitzrayim, one of the things, amongst the things that he brought to Mitzrayim, were big, big cedar trees. Big trees. Where do you get those trees from? Avram Avinu had planted those trees. Yaakov cut them down and brought them with him to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. Why? The Medrash says that eventually when they, if you think about it, they built the Mishkan in the Medrash, in the Midbar. In the middle, when they left Mitzrayim, they built the Mishkan, the tabernacle. How'd they build it? They built it with wood. They built, you know, and each thing was 10 amos. Each, the Mishkan was 100 amos long. That means 100 or 50. I think 50. 50 amos long. 50 amos, 100 feet. So what, how long is that? Here it is. It's long.
Longer than,
you know, this is 35, 40, whatever it is. And 100 feet long, and it was 10 amos tall, which is 20 feet tall. Okay? And what was it made out of? Solid wood. Now, sitting in a desert, all right, where'd they get wood from? You ever thought about that? Where'd they get this wood from to build all that wood?
The trees.
Trees in the desert?
No, the trees that they cut.
Ah. So, obviously, they brought the wood from Egypt with them. Where'd they get the trees from? As they're leaving Mitzrayim, they're cutting down, you know, on the way out, putting the matzahs in the oven, cutting down some trees. Like, what's going on? So the Medrash says it was the trees that Yaakov Avinu brought 210 years earlier from, he had cut down the trees that Avram had planted. He cut them down, he brought them to Mitzrayim, and they were passed down from generation to generation, and they were brought out of Mitzrayim eventually. And with those trees, they built the Mishkan. So,
I mean, that means they knew for what, that was like a prophecy.
Ah.
Like a prophecy. They just were conducting the process to the end.
Right. Meaning to say, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, why did Yaakov Avinu do that? Because your wife's sitting there doing the spring cleaning, all right? And she says, all right, let's get rid of this stuff already. There's this stuff that's sitting here for the last 30 years, these old wood. Can we get rid of this already? You know, let's make room for the rest of the stuff. You know, this stuff is getting dusty. And what does the husband say to the kids when they're doing the cleaning? No, keep it in there because my grandfather told me we're going to build a Mishkan with this. When we leave this place, we're building a Mishkan with this. And year after year, this is being passed down and they're seeing in front of their face wood that was planted by Avram Avinu, that Yaakov Avinu brought down, that they have, that Yaakov told them, bring this out of Mitzrayim, you're going to build a Mishkan with this. It's very powerful.
Yes,
the fact that they were, Yaakov Avinu wanted them to be able to see, he writes there, b'chosh, he wanted them to see it, not just hear that there's a prophecy, we're going to leave. He wanted them to see it and be reminded constantly, we're going to leave, we're going to be out of here soon. And when we're going to be out of here, we're going to build a Mishkan, and we're going to build a way for, we're going to build a house for Hashem, and we have right now the wood to do it. And this is passed down from Yaakov Avinu. So he says, here's the opposite twist. He says, to keep yourself going in Golos, in addition to what the Meshech Chochmah we were saying is that to keep your the past going. But he says there's another point. You have to keep your eyes on the future also. You have to be able to have that emuna that we're going to get out of here eventually. And that also gives a Klal Yisrael the strength. You know, as people are being sent away and they're, you know, in the camps and they're composing new tunes, you know, the Af Al Pi She'Yismameh, that one of the tunes, which one is it now? You know. What? Ani Mamen. That was composed in the camps, you know, in the cars on the way. But you know, the Klal Yisrael could sing that song when they're in the darkest time. That means that their emuna is very strong. And the emuna that eventually we're going to leave. Af Al Pi She'Yismameh B'Chol Yom Hachakel. That even if we don't see it and it's being delayed and we don't see the ultimate redemption right here in front of us, but we believe that Mashiach is going to come. And that strength to keep connected with the future in addition to the past, that's also a very important angle in terms of keeping our identity very strong in Golos. So Rabbi Yaakov brings it out with this Medrash, a beautiful Medrash, beautiful pshat in the Medrash. And then there's a third point, which is the famous idea, but it just, you know, to bring it out, the Medrash, the Pasuk says that Yaakov sent Yehuda originally to go down. Lahoros Lafan of Goshna, to find the way to Goshen, and then the whole family came. So why did he send Yehuda? So Rashi says, the famous Rashi, to build the yeshiva. To build the yeshiva. Yaakov wouldn't come to Mitzrayim until he built the yeshiva first. And the reason that Rashi says that is because it says uses the language of Lahoros. Lahoros is the same shorosh as Torah. So Rashi says from the pasuk. See, a lot of the times these midrashim, just this is for Alex, this thing I'm about to say, is that the midrashim, a lot of times, they're not making up stories. The stories that they're saying very often are coming from peculiar language that's used. In other words, the language wouldn't be the normal language you use to just say that he sent Yehuda down to find the way. You would use a different word. So in the Torah, when Chazal see a peculiar language, so that indicates that there's something else going on. So a lot of times the Medrash seems like it's not the literal Pshat, but in fact, really, the Medrash is more literal sometimes than the Pshat. The Medrash sometimes is more literal than the simple meaning. Because a simple meaning is a simple meaning according to the context, but it's not necessarily a simple meaning according to the actual words that's being used. So the wording that's being used sometimes indicates a midrashic pshat. So that's something to... But he sent the yeshiva down. So again, so this is another key for Golos. Yaakov, and before he would go to Golos, he wanted a yeshiva. And that's another key for survival. The key for survival is that we have to have places which are dedicated and set aside. This is a place to study and this is a place to learn. All right? Now, Rebaruch Ber Libois. Rebaruch Ber Libois was one of the great Rashi yeshiva in Europe. In the yeshivas, we study his chidushim, the things that he wrote. On the Shas, on Gemara, his Shiurim that he gave in the yeshivas, we study that in a lot of places. They study that, and he died in 1939 about. So anyway, I'll tell you a story that he was somebody who the students in the yeshiva felt very, very, he felt he was like a father to the students in the yeshiva. There was a person where I'm from, Silver Spring, Maryland. His name was Rabbi Kaviar. Rabbi Kaviar was an alter yid, an old person, and he got smicha from Rabbi Baruch Ber Libowitz. So he was in the Yeshiva Baruch where he got smicha from Rav Baruch Ber. So he told me, he said, when we were, there was a whole group of Talmidim, of Kamenetz. The Baruch Ber was the Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva in Kamenetz, this town in Poland. There was a whole group of students that were sent to Siberia. And he was amongst that group. And he told me, he said, we couldn't bring any belongings. We couldn't bring anything with us. So we were so I only brought one thing with me. There was a printed volume. They had printed a volume of the Shiurim that Rav Baruch Ber had said in the yeshiva. They had printed that volume. So I took that book, I stuck it in my pants, and I brought it with me. And every night, I would sit down and read that book to be able to feel like my Rebbe was still with me, even in Siberia. So I told him, Mokil Cutler, this story. He was like, you know, he's in a spell from it. So after recently, I went to this guy's house. He passed away, and his son was in the house, and he showed me the book that he had brought with him. He had it. He had the book. And it says in the front, he says, Haya Imi, this book was with me, Begolos Siberia. When I was in Siberia, v'lamadati mimenu tamid, and I constantly learned from it, and it gave me inspiration. So anyway, but this is Baruch Ber, you know, the students, you know, that was their... So anyway, so I'll tell you a vart from Baruch Ber about this thing, about having yeshiva. Okay, there's a famous Gemara, this is a very gishmaka Gemara. The Gemara says that Rabbi Kiva, in the time that the Romans made a decree not to learn Torah, and Rabbi Kiva was makil keheloiz barabim. What does that mean? It means he gathered people in public, and he would learn with the people Torah. So Pappas ben Yehuda came. Pappas ben Yehuda was also a fine Jew, and he said, Rabbi Kiva, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? It's sakanas nefashis. Your mom is going to kill yourself. So he said, Moshel ma'adavar deimer. Rabbi Kiva told him, he said, I don't understand you, Pappas. So I'll give you a story. There was a fish. There's a fish that's in the water. And there was fishermen trying to catch the fish. So the fox comes and tells the fish. The fox is considered the smartest animal in the animal kingdom. The fox comes and tells the fish, Fish, you're crazy. You're staying in the water? There's fishermen trying to find you. Come out to the beach. Come onto the ground. And there you won't find any fishermen over there. You're going to be safe. No one's going to try to catch you. So the fish says back, Shul, the fox, you're the smartest animal in the animal kingdom. Shaita, if I leave the water, I'm for sure going to die. If I stay in the water, maybe I'll die, maybe I won't die. So he said, so Baruch Ber said, one second. We have to understand the fox over here. What did the fox mean? The fox had a hava mina, you know, like in a Gemara. You always have to understand the hava mina. You always have to understand what was he saying? The fox, you know, he is the smartest guy after all. So what was he thinking? Right? So... Says Rav Baruch Ber, he says, the fox wasn't telling the fish to leave the water and go onto the dry land. I mean, obviously, the fish is going to land, die. You know what he was telling him? He was telling, no, come out of the water. Get yourself a fish tank. Get yourself a little bit of a tank of water. And you'll live in the water. But that way, no one's going to catch you. Of course, the fox never meant, now you see why they would like Rav Baruch Ber's shiurim. Gishmak. He says, of course the fox never meant to tell the fish to come out of the water. The fox just meant tell the fish to go into a fish tank. If the fish goes into the fish tank, then you'll be safe from the fishermen. So what is the fish? So that sounds like the fox is really smart now, right? So what's the fish what's the fish saying back to the fox? Huh?
Can't share.
I can't what?
I won't be able to share the Torah. I won't be able to share if I'm all alone in a fish tank,
what good is it? What is it good? So he said, the point that he says, a fish tank is artificial. That's not my natural habitat. A guy can come over and knock over the fish tank and I'm done. Right? The kid is going to come and one day he's going to forget to feed me. You know, he's going to go away on their 3-day vacation to Orlando. Forgot. What should we do about the fish food? You know, call my neighbor. My neighbor's also in Orlando. You know, that's it. We're finished. If I listen to the fox, I'm in a very big danger because I'm not in my natural habitat. It's much safer for me. Stay in my natural habitat. Eat my food. This is where I'm supposed to be. This is where I'm comfortable. If the fisherman catches me, he catches me. But for me to go out of my natural habitat and live in that little fish tank in that guy's living room, that's really dangerous. Because I have no way, I have no guarantee of survival. So Rabbi said that Rabbi Kiva, now let's go back to Rabbi Kiva. Rabbi Kiva was saying this to Papas Ben Yehuda. What was Rabbi Kiva saying to Papas Ben Yehuda? What was he telling him? Rabbi Kiva said like this. What was Papas Ben Yehuda was telling Rabbi Kiva not to learn Torah? I mean, how could that be? Papas Ben Yehuda was a very fine person. He was a Talmud Chacham himself. He was telling Rabbi Kiva you shouldn't learn. No, he was telling Rabbi Kiva you should learn. But don't teach Torah in public. Don't make a big deal about it. Take one student here to learn with him or learn yourself, you know. But don't make a yeshiva. Don't make a public yeshiva. So Rabbi Kiva says the mashal. Rabbi Kiva says, so he says, you're saying like the fox. You're saying that, of course I should learn, but I should learn by myself, quietly in my corner. I shouldn't go into yeshiva. So he says, the fish's answer is, no, you have to be in your natural habitat. It's much more dangerous to make an artificial situation. So he says, the natural habitat of a Jew, of a Yid, is in a yeshiva. That's where we have to make a habitat for ourselves. We have to make an environment for ourselves. We have to make an environment of Torah. This is what we are all about. We're about making places of learning, of studying, of tefillah, about the knesias, about the midrashas, places that we can come in public. This is what we're... If they're going to catch me, if the fisherman's going to catch me there, so be it. But that's my... I can't leave my habitat. For me to leave and just, you know, study myself in my corner and all that, then I'm for sure putting myself in danger. A Yid needs to make his natural habitat a base medrash, a base knesses, and with that, and then you worry about the fisherman later. So that was where Rav Ochber explained this Gemara. Beautiful explanation, huh? Yeah. It's clever, no?
There was a story similar by Rabbi Fisher, but was with a wolf.
Uh-huh. All right, so. But I think the fox is smarter than the wolf, in general.
but actually, it was in a village. Yeah. In a village, and this wolf every night, you know, was getting down the village and killing the cows and killing this. I mean, nobody in the fence. Everybody was defenseless. Right. So they went to talk to the rabbi and mm-hmm. say, "Listen, you have to do something about it."
Mm-hmm.
And he went to look for the wolf.
uh-huh.
And he spoke to him.
Uh-huh.
He says, what's going on with you? He says, you're terrorizing all these people. That's not normal. You're a creature of God. This is not...
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, it was cold. I was hungry. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
All the priests gave me this. You don't have to worry now. You come down with me. And from now on, you have to have everything you need.
Uh-huh.
And the people saw him coming down.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So go to shul with the rabbi. He mincha, marif, all saintly things. Everything was beautiful. But then the rabbi left to another town to teach Torah. Didn't like it. He went back to the same thing.
Right.
And he went back, but he describes the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
Went back.
So the point being that
he went back to look for it. He said, well, what happened?
Right.
I mean, everything was. And then the wolf says, very simple. I was happy. Listen to your prayers. Then I saw something I didn't like.
Which was?
All these guys around me, which I thought they were good people. I saw hate. And then I consider myself a wolf, but better than those people.
Yeah.
And then I say, well, I'm going to handle it myself.
Yeah.
It's a whole story.
The whole story, yeah. But here the idea being that a different twist, that Yaakov, as he's entering into Golos, he's again protecting himself from the ultimate, you know, from the challenges of Golos. So the way we're describing it is there was three steps. One is connection to the past. One is connection to the future. And one is connection to our natural habitat, being the yeshiva, the shul, that place where we can be ourselves. And that's the third level of protection. Now, as you learn the parashiyos, you see that Yosef also did his share in protecting the Jewish people through in th- from the future exile in Egypt. Because in last week's parasha, we learned all sorts of things that Yosef did that doesn't really seem to make that much sense. And the Mefarshim say the reason he did those things is to really protect the Jewish people for when they would come from the exile. So I'll just give you a few examples. As we, you know, we'll finish with these, but a few examples. One example is, he took everyone's land and he moved everyone. Not only took possession of the land, but he moved everyone from place to place. So, meaning to say that he would take one person's land and he would own it, and he would make every single Egyptian guy move to someone else's land during the course of the famine. So that when the Jewish people came, they were relocated, but so was everyone else. So they were no worse than anyone else. So there was nobody that could feel like, hey, it's our place and you're visiting here, so you should become like us. Because you're not the local, the locals themselves weren't so comfortable where they were. So that's one thing Yosef did. Another thing Yosef did is he made a law that clergy doesn't serve or doesn't pay taxes. So that allowed that Shevet Levi never served in later. They applied the same rules to the Jewish people. So Shevet Levi never ended up having to work during the whole time of the slavery in Egypt. And the reason that was significant is I think it's a connection to the thing we just said with the yeshivas, because Shevet Levi ended up keeping the flame, keeping Torah alive. And they were able to study because they didn't have to do the hard work. So that's another thing Yosef did in order to establish, you know, safety for the Jewish people in the exile. So both Yaakov and Yosef did their share before the Jewish people came into the exile in order to protect themselves. And that's really, you know, the connection. This is Vayechi is really a connection to that parsha. If you look in Atikun, if you look in a Sefer Torah, Vayechi is a very, very unique parsha. It's the only parsha in the whole Torah that's like this. Okay, and that is that in the Sefer Torah, when you read, Vayechi does not start a new line. Vayechi continues the parsha. It's a new parsha, but it just continues right at the end of last week's parsha. It just continues along into Vayechi. So as opposed to every other parsha in the Torah, it starts a new line with that parsha, or at least there's a break. And Vayechi is not like that. And the reason for that is that you know, there was. It says here, Lefisha Kivan Shinifta Yaakov Avinu Nistumu Einayim V'Libon Shel Yisrael Mitzaras Hashibud. They didn't have room. They were so, you know, if they felt enclosed with that. But it symbolizes these are the parshas of Golas. This is when they first entered into the Golas. But at the same time, you know, these are where you see the blocks for how to survive the Golas. And the Maisa Avos Simin L'Banim, like we started off with, is the way that the first exile that we experienced as a people was in Mitzrayim. So for us, what we're experiencing now, we, you know, for us to survive, we have to just take the lessons that the way they survived and apply that in our own lives. I'll just tell you another story that I just mentioned to you, that Shevet Levi was able to study because they didn't work, right? This Yid who I mentioned before, Rabbi Caviar, he said that every night after they would work the whole day in Siberia, he had a chavrusa with the Chibina Rav. The Chibina Rav was a Rav later became a Rav in Eretz Yisrael, and he was a goyin, he was a tremendous, tremendous goyin. He knew, so he said, this Rabbi Caviar told me, he said, after, we didn't have Sfarim, we didn't have Gemaras, we sat and we learned Gemara Baal Peh, we learned Gemara by heart. After all the work in Siberia, the Chibina Rav would say the Gemara, Baal Peh. He'd say by heart the whole Gemara, say the Rashi, Baal Peh, say the Tosfos, Baal Peh, by heart, word for word. And then they would learn it together, by heart. And that was the Chibina Rav, you know. But the point is not that he knew it by heart. The point is that after a whole day's work, that has no shaykhis to us. But what we could learn from that is that after a whole day's work, he still was able to sit down and learn, you know, that was the pell from the story. The fact that he knew it by heart, it's like, okay, he knew it by heart, it has nothing to do with us. We can't relate to that. But
having a book is a luxury, you know?
right. No, a corollary of that story is that there was a big reshiva that just was nifter about 6 months ago in America, in Cleveland, Reb Chaim Stein, Chaim Stein was a Shiva in Tells in Cleveland, and he also was in Siberia. He was over 100, so he was in Siberia also. And I had a Rebbe that used to learn b'chavrusa every day at lunchtime with Reb Chaim Stein. Okay, and they would go through Shas. They would go through the whole Talmud, and they would learn together. And he said it came to the Masechta of Menachos, which is a hard Masechta. And they came to Masechta Menachos, and he would fly through it. And my Rebbe told me he couldn't keep up with Reb Chaim Stein. He couldn't keep up with him. I mean, he just had to like, it's like his fingers was going down the page. So he said, like, he asked him afterwards, like, why is this Masechta so different than all the others? So he told him, because when I was in Siberia, I didn't have any other Gemara. I only had a Masechta Menachos. And I learned it 14 times when I was in Siberia. These people, you know, that was unbelievable. So for him, you know, he knew Menachos. That was his Masechta. But anyway.
And why is it that, I mean, I know answers, but I want to know from you. Why is it that learning Torah in Galut is the solution?
Because the connection that we have to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the way He reveals Himself to us, is through the Torah. So the more we connect with the Torah, the more that's how we can connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In davening, we speak to Hashem, but in learning, He speaks to us. So for us to know what's important, for us to have any shaychis, to feel connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you have to be connected to Him through the learning of the Torah. This is the chachma that He gave down into this world to say, listen, for you to feel and understand and feel that you have a connection with me, you have to do it through the Torah, through studying the Torah. That's the chachma that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put in this world for us to be able to connect to Him through.
And Dafka in Galut?
No, but in Galus, it's especially important, because in the Beis HaMikdash, so you could go to the Beis HaMikdash and do Avoda. But you don't even have that today. So what are you going to do? The only way you can connect to Hashem Baruch Hu is not through sacrifice, not through anything else. The only thing which really we have, which may some say is not really on the same level as it was during the Beis HaMikdash, but in some sense is really a little bit we can connect to it the same way we did when we were there. This didn't change in Galus necessarily. I mean, some say it did, but you know, theoretically, the Torah is still around, well, as it was before. You could study now the same way you did before. You can't do karbanos, you can't do service, you can't do other things, but this you could. So that's a specific way for us to feel connected to Kadosh Baruch Hu.
The technique could be considered more eternal, because the only truth that's eternal is, you know,
Hashem. Right.
Torah is eternal.
Right. No one can take that away from us.
Right. So that's what replicates more.
Right.
Can't
replicate
Hashem, but it's closest to
it. Right. If you understand, it's like, you know, the Gemara says that, the Rambam says that there's two ways to know a Kadosh Baruch Hu, feel that you know Hashem, you know God. One is by looking into nature. You can look into nature and see how great nature is. That gives you a glimpse into God. Another way is to study Torah. But studying Torah is much better. So what's the difference? It's just, the idea is like this. Let's say you want to know somebody. You want to get to know somebody. Lahavdo. So there's one way to do it is, you could follow him around for like 3 weeks. You know, spy. And follow around what he does for 3 weeks, all right? So you know what time he gets up in the morning, what he likes to wear, what he does, where he goes, his schedule. You know everything about the guy, okay? So you probably know him pretty well, because you know everything he likes to do, everything he does, right? But Lamaisa, you don't know what he's, you don't really know, because maybe he's only doing that because that's his job and he's getting paid for it, but he doesn't really enjoy it. You never saw if he would rather go play golf, right? He never did, because he's too busy. So you know what he does, but you don't know, you know. The other way to do it is, theoretically, is you get into the, get a chip, get into his mind, and hang out over there for a little bit. Then you'll really know then you'll really know him, because then you know what he's thinking and what he thinks is important and what he would prefer to do. So lahavdil, looking at HaKadosh Baruch Hu through nature is like looking at his actions, looking what he does. This is what he does. Hashem does that. Okay, he made a world, right? He makes the sun come up, so you get a glimpse. You understand, Hashgacha Pratis, reading stories about how he protects us and everything. But learning Torah is like Kaviyachal, getting it, this is what Kadosh Baruch Hu's mind, Kaviyachal, I'm just saying, you know, the idea is, this is what he's thinking, this is the values that he's giving us, this is the Torah that he's giving us. That's a whole different thing. So the most powerful way to be connected to God is through the learning of Torah.
Very nice.
Okay, so let's call it
Chazak Baruch.